restrictions out here pretty soon, but we won't know how much until the planters are out actually out there in the field and we can chart that. But there is talk of that. Some of that will move from soybeans over to corn. If you look at that situation, soybeans had the largest crop ever last year and the largest carryover we've ever had. So we have a pretty good cushion there with soybeans. Then you do have some producers who are near the ethanol plant, and the DDGs work very well for them. So in those situations, you take some of the pressure off. What I would say is I think the next couple of years, as I've said before, are years where there is very definitely adjustment. We're seeing that now. But having said that, as you look to the future, the emphasis, as the detail has now come out on our farm bill proposals, relates to building cellulosic ethanol. $1.5 billion there for research and development, $2.1 billion loan program for the actual construction of the plants. There isn't any doubt we have a lot of biomass out there. We have a conservation program, which we're proposing, that says you can stay in conservation, do all the environmental requirements, make sure you're not interfering with nesting season for birds, but allow a harvest of that grass for cellulosic purposes. Farmers are going to like that, and I think it's going to work well in accomplishing our environmental goals. So when you put the whole package together and all of the ideas, I really do believe we've got the right plan in place, and as we continue to move here, you're going to take some of the pressure off corn that we see today. The answer is absolutely. If you go to Brazil, and I have been there myself, and I've been to an ethanol plant in Brazil, their raw material is sugarcane. Now, we grow sugarcane here, of course, in the south. We have had a fairly protected sugar program, as you know. We're proposing some change there. And so our cane and our beets have gone to sugar. But the technology is there. The science is there. There isn't any reason why the biomass that produces ethanol couldn't be sugarcane, or maybe even sugar beets for that matter. Not only are we open to that suggestion, but we're encouraging. We think that's also part of the puzzle here. So our hope is that the sugar industry will look to the future, because I believe there's a very bright future there, and you're absolutely right. What your question implies is absolutely happening. Sugarcane is the product in Brazil. There isn't a reason why it can't be a product here for the production of ethanol. Yes, ma'am. We continue to study the issue of early out of CRP acres. A couple of things I would mention. I just caution people, and I think people realize this. 1 acre out of CRP does not equal an acre of corn. A lot of that CRP ground is truly good for conservation. It would not be a good phenomena to move all of the CRP or a substantial portion and try to grow corn on that ground. It's not suited for it. It is good for conservation. We're happy to have it in conservation and very supportive of keeping it there. But if you'll remember in our re-enrollment period, we did something a little bit differently here. We had some two-year sign-ups. We had some short-term sign-ups for CRP. And a farmer in that short term may look at this and say, you know, this land can grow corn effectively or soybeans or whatever, and decide to move in that direction. The other thing I will tell you, we continuously study this issue of CRP acres and whether there would be an early out, and we'll continue to do that. We pay attention to the corn supplies. We'll continue to look in the weeks and months ahead at this issue. We haven't done anything differently yet, but we continue to study the issue and continue to study supplies. Yes, there will be a budget, and these days I just simply would avoid commenting on the budget itself, just simply because it's the president's right to release his budget, not a cabinet secretary, especially the Secretary of Agriculture. Having said that, though, I can tell you that the proposals we put out there will fit within the president's goal of eliminating the federal deficit within the next 5 years. These proposals were built with input from OMB, and so I am authorized to say that what I released a couple of days ago, which actually spends $5 billion more than if we just reauthorized the O2 Farm Bill, that proposal does fit within the President's plan to balance the budget in the next 5 years. Yeah. Here's kind of the drill on a quip. When we went out and did the forums, farmers, ranchers showed up and said, you know, your conservation programs are great. We had not unanimous approval of our conservation programs, but very, very strong approval. But a pretty consistent theme was they're so dang complicated. You have so many programs that you're confusing everybody about which program might work for me and which program I might qualify for. And I will be honest with you, at times we confused ourselves at the USDA. What we have done is we have proposed a consolidation of those programs in a new EQIP program, and I can tell you what we're working on there. The newly designed EQIP program will increase simplicity and accessibility to the program, so we're consolidating, and then we're adding to that an additional $4.2 billion. Now, in one of those base programs, 60% is to be devoted to this industry. So where that will end up when the Farm Bill is done, I don't know. But I can tell you it's a program that's worked very, very well for the cattle industry. We believe in it. This is going to be a better program, much more understandable, and it's responsive to what cattlemen were telling us. Well, I would hope so. I must admit I didn't study backlog as such, but we're putting $4.2 billion more into it, so you would have to think we'll be more aggressive in reaching out there and doing some things. And again, this was one area where if we got a criticism, it was too complicated, and we would like you to see if there's some way you could increase funding here, because it is a program we like. It's just not accessible to a lot of people. We think this would deal with those problems. Yes, sir. We haven't set a time limit on it, to answer your second question. And my memory here, Terry, if I'm not mistaken, on the 1031, it applies only to the commodity programs. You could still do a conservation program. Even with our payment limit proposal, you could still do a conservation program. Could not receive the cash subsidies. Yes. Well, I don't know if this one item stops the escalation of farm prices. There's a lot of things that influence that, as you know. But I will tell you, as we listen to farmers out there, the 1031 is really a burr in their saddle. I mean, really a burr in their saddle. And here's what we heard. It's whether on the stage or off the stage, farmers were pointing out, look, somebody sells a commercial property. They come out here into ranch country or farming country. Their interest is to protect that gain, and that's what the tax code allows them to do, roll that over, protect the gain. They're not quite as interested as the farmer or rancher necessarily in getting that land at the best bottom dollar price. So the farmer is out there trying to expand his or her operation, trying to add some land for a son or daughter who wants to farm, and saying, I can't compete. There's no way I can compete with this. So we thought it was a valid point, and we made a proposal that we're not affecting the Internal Revenue Code, can't do it anyway. You can continue to do this. No problem whatsoever. It's just that the cash commodity payments would not be made on that land. And like I said, we did not set a time limit on it. You know, I offered some thoughts about that. Number of things I would mention relative to disaster relief. We believe we've got a very sound policy proposal. Number one, there is no question that moving to a revenue-based countercyclical program will make the situation better for farmers and ranchers. Here's why. Or for farmers who are raising program crops. Here's why. And again, farmers told us this. I had a farmer from Kansas at the forum we did there who showed up and said, you know, I didn't get anything. because I didn't raise the crop. That sounded counterintuitive because everybody said, well, the 2002 bill is all about safety net. How could he not be getting anything? So I came back to the USDA and started to look at this. And what farmers were saying to me is, Mike, it's logical. You can't LDP something you didn't raise. They're right. The loan deficiency payment doesn't give you anything if you didn't raise the crop. And then they said the price goes up because there tends to be a shortage, not shortage, but supply and demand. If there's less commodity out there, you're going to have a higher price. Well, what happens to the countercyclical? It's never triggered. Where's the safety net? Here this farmer is probably at the most desperate point of their farming career. They haven't raised a crop, and we say, too bad, under the 2002 Farm Bill. Because they're not getting the LDP, they're not getting the countercyclical. So our proposal turns this to a revenue-based proposal. So if that farmer experiences a revenue drop based upon the criteria developed, then that farmer is in a situation where they get the loan or the countercyclical payment. So it's a much better proposal in that regard. The other thing that we have proposed to do, and we heard this from farmers also, they said, the problem with crop insurance is I can't cover the gap. You know, I can insure 70% or whatever, but there's 30% or whatever the number is that's uninsured. And many farmers said, I can't afford that, especially in years of successive drought. So we went back, went to work on that, and we're making a proposal that you can buy gap coverage and cover 100%. Now, a farmer that's well-established may look at that and say, well, I would not want to lose 30%, but it wouldn't put me out of business. I would not go broke. I can stand that risk. The next farmer looks at it and says, I can't. I need to buy the gap coverage. It's a voluntary program. Buy the gap coverage. It will be available to give you 100% coverage. Now, let me talk about the, and I'm not sure what Congressman Peterson will be proposing. Anxious to sit down and visit with him about it. But let me offer a thought. What if we just said, okay, we found $4 billion annually, and we'll drop it into a budget kind of system over here, and then every year when we need to send out money for disaster relief, we'll send it out. Okay, what if you're in an area where maybe you grow a corn crop 2 years out of five because you're in a drier part of the country? Those 2 years are good. The other three, you don't grow a crop at all because it's just hot, dry country. Should we cover those 3 years? Should we say to that person out there, we've got you covered? Convert that land from whatever it's doing now into corn or whatever you want to grow, and in those years where you don't get a crop, we will cover that loss for you. Okay, what does that do to land values on dry land? What are you doing to the marketplace? All of these policy issues are really, really important issues. I would suggest that we have a pretty good vehicle here, and if we can improve that vehicle through things like gap coverage and give that farmer assurance that they can protect that risk, provide for that risk, that might be a more thoughtful policy approach. Now, again, I'm anxious to hear ideas, and I'm not exactly certain what Congressman Peterson will propose. We'll sit down, we'll talk through this, but those would be some of the things I would talk to him about. Let me get Sarah here. Somebody in your business, I think, has said that dairy policy is so complex that when you finally understand it, you've probably been around long enough and you should leave. So, and it is. It is hopelessly complex, and I think I'm getting a better understanding of it, probably a pretty good understanding. Here's what I would say. It is so complex. Dairy is so varied depending upon the part of the country you're in that we decided our proposal should keep the basic elements. Now, we have made some changes in the milk income loss program and size that differently. It does stair-step down over our proposal and that sort of thing. But you're right, the basic structure is there. I have had a number of conversations with folks in the dairy industry, and these programs are hotly debated within the industry itself. They have indicated to me that they have had conversations within their industry about what might work in the current plan, what might work better, and I have told them, as you develop your ideas, let's sit down, and we would be happy to do that. But you're right, the dairy program, other than the changes we've made, is very truly the same structure that we had, we have had for a lot of years. I believe that that piece is really critical. We're on the cutting edge. We really were out there first to seek that classification. You know how much I preach. We will live by international standards. We expect you to live by international standards. We are not only talking the talk, we are walking the walk. We'll get that classification, and that gives us another basis to say, here's what the OIE is saying about our beef. And then it gives us very specific approach, if you will, to marketing beef under international standards on a worldwide basis. So what it allows me to do, and Susan Schwab, our USTR, to do, is to go in and say, this is what the OIE says we can do under these standards. Beef should be going into your country. So it's very important. I don't believe it does. The WTO does not like to see the world entering into all of these bilateral agreements, but here's what I would say. I think we need both. I really do. I think in order to be effective, we not only need to be aggressive with our multilateral WTO-type approaches, we need to be aggressive on a bilateral basis. There just simply are some parts of the world where we have a bilateral interest. The CAFTA countries, perfect example. This was part of an overall strategy to improve those economies, stabilize those economies, improve their situation. And this started 20, 25 years ago. That was the right bilateral approach. We do not want our hands tied on our ability to reach out to a part of the world or a part of or a country in our part of the world where literally we believe that trading relationship is critical. We don't want to lose that ability. So I believe you have to have both. We've been looking, Argentina probably would not be the only area where we've got countries making requests. And I'm not exactly certain as to what the timeline is for that to occur, but I'm guessing there's testing and probably some rulemaking. Again, not exactly certain. Again, here's what it comes down to, whether it's Argentina or whoever. We will endeavor to live by international standards. That's what we have to do. You know, I can give great speeches about selling our beef everywhere in the world and what other countries need to do. And I will not back down a second in demanding that they do what they need to do under international standards. I think I would lose all of my credibility if my response was, and by the way, we won't be living under those international standards. And at times this is tough because people out there in the industry will say, what's he doing? I will tell you, whether it's Argentina or whoever, we will do no more nor less than what we believe is necessary under the international standards, and that's kind of where we're at. And that's kind of how we would approach that one. So. Well, we will want to make sure that those problems are solved. We will want to make sure that, and again, whether it's a BSE situation or FMD, we want to make sure that those problems are dealt with. And we would not change our position unless they were. So we will very cautiously approach that. Maybe one last question, Terry, and then we'll head up. I think the only one who has said anything that I would say was even remotely critical was the European Union. They said something so quickly, I doubt that they had an opportunity to study what we had put out there. And I say that respectfully. It's a very complicated proposal. I will tell you, when they study our proposal and see what we have done, I suspect that they will say a lot less. This is a very reform-oriented proposal. If they matched our ambition, the world would change pretty quickly. you know, I'd just say to the European Union, you know, the days of having your market protected and closed, I think, are coming to an end. Our farmers are being asked to compete in a world marketplace. Their farmers, they can compete in a world marketplace. So I guess what I would say to them is study the proposal, and then I'd be happy to sit down with them and explain to them how reform-oriented we are. We've set a new standard for discussion, in my personal opinion. Okay, thanks, everybody.